Dave Fanning on 2FM.
That's a good start. Okay, I'm going to play something here for you now because there's a brilliant documentary out at the moment. In fact, I'll tell you what, I'll play a piece of music here first. It's from Mick Christopher and it's called Heyday. And you definitely know this. Are you ready? Here goes. This is a heyday, baby. And we're not going to be afraid to shout. Because we can make a heyday last forever. And ain't that what it's all about? Okay, I know a lot of you are going to associate that with the Guinness ad. You know, the guy kind of walks across mountains and all the rest of it and swims the ocean to get to America to say sorry to his pal in the pub, face to face, that is. Michael Fassbender is actually that actor in that. Anyway, the Mick Christopher story, or Heyday, which is the name of that, Heyday, the Mick Christopher story. It's a new film that looks at the life of the singer-songwriter Mick Christopher, who passed away at the age of just 32 back in 2001. The film is directed by Alan Leonard and produced by Neil Carver, and it features interviews with Sharon Horgan and Glenn Hansard and Mike Scott, Josh Ritter and loads more besides. And they're both here now with us on the programme this morning. Thanks a million for getting up so early, boys and girls. Let's start, first of all, with this. Mick Christopher, in fact, I'll tell you what, I'll start with you, Neil, because Mick Christopher, who was Mick Christopher to those who didn't know who Mick Christopher was?
Mick was part of the busking scene in Dublin. We're talking about the late 1980s. Yeah. So that's where he came from. And he was like a leading light among all of those people. We're talking about Glenn Hansard and Keela, Paddy Casey, Mundy, Damien Rice coming afterwards. All of these guys who came from that busking scene on Grafton Street. And Mick was one of those, one of the centre characters of that like really important scene, and he was, as you said, he was struck down in his prime, about age 32.
Yeah.
He was somebody who had in his band the Mary Janes shown so much promise. The band had really shown so much promise as a band who could have, should have been a lot bigger than they were. He was to his friends and the people who knew him,
yeah,
a huge inspiration in his lifetime.
He really was. And all the things that they all say, I mean, like, he's so up there and yet wouldn't necessarily be known in a kind of a household name kind of way. But to a scene that you mentioned, and it is that scene that I want to talk about for a second, because, Alan, you actually get that whole scene of what it was. I mean, like, obviously most of it's from Den Hansard, just of what it meant to be just playing music. In fact, I think it says, Paddy Casey at one stage says, like, it wasn't the radio, it wasn't the television, whatever. It was just an organic, I've used the word, sorry, thing that was happening on the streets and went into the clubs then through Mary Jane's, whatever. But it was really a busking kind of Glenn Hansard-y kind of thing, wasn't it? It's great when the two of them meet and all that kind of stuff, the way he talks about the kind of person he is, you know?
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. Within that scene in the late 80s, nearly everyone who kind of broke big in the early 2000s came from that one spot. They were actually in one, say, extended group is about 20 people, but if you see the photographs and the footage, like, most of those guys have gone on to be very much household names. It was very much a, as Paddy Casey said, a little magic circle.
But the band that Neil mentioned there, I mean, like the band, the Mary Janes themselves, they kind of just, they petered out, didn't they, really? They just, they let themselves become whatever, a footnote almost.
I've a theory on that. I wasn't there, so I can't speak for this as to be absolute fact. But if you watch a documentary, we interview the band and the manager, and the manager says they did something like 300 gigs a year.
Yeah.
And we acquired all this footage of them coming back in the van from Cork, and they weren't touring on their doorstep. They were traveling the country, and they seemed to only have an album really at the start of their career and toward the end.
Yeah.
And like, it's a 9-year span. It's not a lot of time for just two albums. But if you listen to the quality jump, the second album is amazing. It's like Pearl Jam quality. It's super fantastic music. But it seems maybe they spent too much time. Well, it looks like they maybe spent too much time gigging and working. And maybe by the time they came to sparkle into this great band with a great second album, that they were kind of burnt out.
Right, they were kind of burnt out. But did Mick have the support around him that he would have wanted? And I get the impression that's what he had the most of. I mean, the amount of people from the car and David Odlums and everybody else and everybody talking about how great he was. Like, there were people there to help him all the way. He had a good supporting family too. Although, when it's 15 minutes, was it, to the some exam he had to do, and there he was still rehearsing in his bedroom. It's obviously he wasn't going to be doing exams. So, right, let him be the musician that he wants to be. And he does, and he does all that. Meets Glenn on the street, etc. And there's lovely pieces of all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, you know, he just wanted to make music, and he just wanted to do music. And there was lots of people saying, well, let's do it this way, let's do it that way. Do you think in some ways he didn't have the final push himself?
I think there was something there that he, there was a struggle with the nature of making it, selling out, this kind of indie mentality.
I know,
which,
yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, it kind of came from the punk thing, the you know, to be careerist was to be dirty. And it's this idea.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of that there, which was a struggle for Mick and other people of that generation, I think, as well. Yeah, they wanted it. Yeah, they wanted to get the record deals to take it to the next level. And they wanted to be successful, but they felt a little dirty. I think there was a sense of that there. So it was always this struggle where maybe other people, maybe other peers were able to just go straight for it. It wasn't as clear cut as that for me.
Yeah, because you have a scene which he's in a room and the camera's going around the table and that you can see a bit of Dublin outside from up above or whatever.
Mm.
And it's just the whole idea of having to deal with things called, you know, like royalties or money that might come in or deals from record companies. That was the last thing he ever wanted to do.
Yeah, he did not see himself as any kind of business, you know, orientated person. It was there was a purity there, you know. It was all about they came from the streets where they picked up their guitars as their weapon of choice to this is how we're going to conquer the world. For him, that he couldn't marry that with the idea of the business.
That's
world,
exactly so. What I'm talking about. And that's the bit. Could I just say, I mean, like, you know, you're there now. Well, we are. That's gone, isn't it?
Well, you know what isn't gone, which is amazing. And these guys have created it. If you walk down Grafton Street on a Saturday, you'll see 13-year-old kids, maybe so young that the parents are still there watching them, and they'll have their Facebook and their Instagram and all their stuff playing original music on Grafton Street. And there's no other street in the world like that where you will see that. And Mick and his generation, they created that. People see it, the kids, you know, see it now as a step towards doing something, making a career with their own original music, which I think is a gift they gave to the generations that came after them.
Yeah, indeed. No, that is definitely true. All right. And Alan, just taking up Mick Christopher of what he did, like outside of Ireland. I mean, he went away. He did Glastonbury as well, didn't they? They did Bosnia and New York, etc. And Sharon Horgan's in it big time in terms of how they went there and what happened there in London, etc. Just fill us in a bit of kind of Mick outside of Ireland stuff.
He seemed to, in the late 80s, himself and Sharon went to London, just, I suppose, widen the busking circle. But when he got there, it seems he wasn't as protected as he was in Dublin. So things were a lot harder. There wasn't as much money. There wasn't, obviously, a solid roof over his head every night. So I think the more he strayed away from the Dublin location on his initial trips, you could see it was a bit more of a struggle, and himself and Ronan O'Snodick took off in a second adventure after that and went deeper into Europe, and they had the same experience. So it really all harkened back to Grafton Street as a kind of...
But there was another side to him, like when you go to Bosnia and that. Like, he was obsessed with like being good as he could possibly be to kids, small kids who didn't have a chance.
Mm. Like Brona Gallagher says it in the film that he was the first one of any of them to actually go, oh, hang on a second here, we... not just have a responsibility, but hey, we could do something here and help people with our music and with the fact that we're able to reach out and help. Mick really felt that, and his traveling with his music wasn't about so much about him trying to, again, be careerist in any way. It was about
what
he could do, what music could mean to other people. It could save in some way, introduce people to music. Kids in Bosnia, war-torn Bosnia. And Mick was very young, you know. Brona points that out in it as well. And you see him because he's very boyish looking. He's in his, you know, he's young, a young man, like, and... that's what he's seeing, this idea, this, you know, it's quite spiritual thing.
Okay, now on the note of just Mick Christopher himself, just fill us in exactly about like who Mick Christopher actually was. Like, his parents are in the film, obviously, like, and the family is there. Where did he come from and how did he start with the music?
He was initially born in New York, and they came back here when he was about 3 years old. And it seems, talking to the parents, music was always there. like, you know, he was supposed to be studying, he was in the bedroom.
And as Lane said, I'd never met anybody from Clondalkin.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was, his focus was entirely music. Like, his dad tried to get him on the 9 to 5, and, you know, again, music was his calling. So there's never a moment where he stepped out, so he went to musical school. I mean, there was never a moment where that wasn't going to be his direction.
And do you think a lot of the people, all the people who were interviewed in the movie, do you think a lot of them are kind of still scratching their heads, like, what are you supposed to do? Because it's Len Hansard said at one stage, what happens to a spirit which is so full of life, and like, just, and the light is just taken out, kind of thing. It's a kind of, they all seem to be there before the grace of God, almost.
There is that sense. I mean, it's the idea of a young man or a person being struck down in their prime, that you know, the brain can't compute that. For the friends who loved him, there's still, many of them have told me, like, feeling in shock. So it's a death they can't get over, the idea that, you know, Mick was just taken so suddenly. And also because he was somebody who in his life and in his relationships with them while he was alive was an inspiration to them,
yeah,
all the time.
He was.
He was a very charismatic performer, but as a friend to each and every one, and a huge wide breadth of friends that he had. And he was a big inspiration to them all when he was alive. And the idea of him just being taken from them, it seemed to then spur, you know, a lot of that generation of people in the film spoke about how it gave them a newfound carpe diem. We only get one life. It's short. You got to go for it. And you know,
yeah, you really do get that feeling from all of them. All right. But like his songs, Mick's songs, they express this kind of spiritual questions, and it may be in a Hindu kind of thing. I don't know what it was exactly that, like, he went Krishnas, he went, you know, kind of, you know, born agains, he went as the mystics and the witches, all this, like, tell me about, like, he went to London and what exactly?
Mick went to London in the 80s. It's when him and Sharon Horgan were a couple, and they, you know, the squat scene was a thing there, so they were living in squats, and kind of, they were very young, in his late teens at that point maybe, and played, you know, went from, became a busker in London and tried to get some music started there. He was a seeker, you know, he was curious, yeah, about the world and spirituality, and when he came back to Dublin, that's when he really, London was a diversion, but it was his path to coming back to Dublin to decide, right, I'm going to be a musician now. I think if London did anything for him, it kind of told him, go back to Dublin and start a band.
Because, like, Damien Rice's album, Oh, dedicated to him, all Frames albums dedicated to him. Lisa Hannigan had Splishy Splash on the Seeso album as well. He was gifted. I'm getting the impression, really, that when you watch the film, it's much more than just a musician. He wasn't just gifted as a musician. As a person, he really, really seemed to, I don't know, relate to people in some way. And yet, under the radar, he wasn't exactly on the Late Late kind of every 5 minutes or something like that, you know?
Yeah, he had a huge inspiration on people all the time. So many people said to us he was their best friend, and they knew in saying that he was everybody's best friend. He was the person that people went to with their problems. He was the person who people gave advice to everybody. And then he, you know, musically, he had this touch with genius. This
he did, but do you think he was willful in some ways? Like, you know, 9 minute sort of jams on stage of just all over the place sometimes annoyed some people, no?
I don't know. I mean, that was part of the journey. I mean, again, that was the Mary Janes. That was late 80s into early 90s. That progressed, and it became more succinct, clearer. It crystallized in the Sham, the Mary Janes' second album. It's timeless. When we started making this, listening to it and living with it for the last, like, number of years, you listen to it and listen to other records released around 98, 99, it stands head and shoulders above it. It's timeless.
I know, but there's a great bit of the thing where, like, what I just said earlier about Fizzled Out, you know, that gig in the rain with all the water coming down everybody with their umbrellas, it's just, okay, maybe it's time to go kind of thing. Is that why you used that? Wasn't the last gig or anything, was it? Or?
No, that was
Bosnia.
Yeah. Oh yeah, right.
That was the grand opening, like, that was the grand opening of the Pavarotti Centre.
So they were very funny.
They were supposed to go to, it's like, U2. You see, it's in the footage, you know, everyone is there. And, like, you kind of, we heard about this gig for so long, and we only got footage as we went along in the documentary. So you kind of visualize this Pavarotti gig with, like, a big stadium. But then when you get to it, it's just they're in a war-torn, bullet-ridden, blown-up buses and jeeps all around them, and it's lashing rain.
Well,
on top
the
of
closing
them.
Credits of the documentary, it's called Heyday, by the way, the Mick Christopher story. The closing credits, everybody is back on for a second or two who's been on the whole thing, and they're all saying the same kind of thing, that he was an old man. He was kind of an old guy, in the best possible way. He'd sit there with a cup of tea and tell you stories if he was still around, kind of thing. He'd be 50 next weekend. So did you get that sense that he kind of had an awful lot more going on up here than maybe a lot of the musicians around?
I think so. I think he did. And, you know, no disrespect to anybody, Mick stood apart from all of the people, even that he was among musically, I think, lyrically. And then as a dude, as a guy, as a friend, as a... I think he's one of those rare people that people, you know, are blessed to have in their life.
Well, you certainly get that impression from the film, all right? Heyday, the Mick Christopher story is what it's called, and it's looking at the life of the singer-songwriter Mick Christopher, who passed away at the age of just 32 in 2001 when he had an accident on tour with the Waterboys. Back in 2001, yeah. Okay, so listen, guys, the movie itself is on Saturday, September 28th. Is that next Saturday or Saturday after?
Saturday week.
That's the Saturday after, okay, right, okay. Next Saturday week at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin. It's part of the IFI Documentary Festival. And isn't there a gig next weekend as well, a big gig?
There is, because as you said, it's Mick's 50th
yeah.
birthday.
And 25 and bands or something.
In Whelan's, this previous Saturday or the Saturday before, the 21st, everybody from Sharon Horgan and Tim Burgess to all of the Irish people who will all be there. Huge. I'm not sure if there's still tickets for that, but
I
it's a huge
that somehow,
Mick
but you
party.
Never know. Listen, thank you very much, guys, for coming in, and congratulations, Alan Leonard and Neil Carver as well. Just one last thing, where else might it be shown after September 28th at the IFI?
It'll be doing the festival circuit between now and next year. There's a whole bunch of festivals coming online, and they're not quite the dates aren't quite public yet. Keep an eye on the social media, Heyday Film.
Sure.
That's on Twitter and on Facebook and festivals.
All right, Neil. Listen, thanks a million for dropping in, and Alan as well. Good luck, folks.
Dave Fanning on 2FM.